This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.
Please, speak as you might to a young child or a golden retriever.
It's an unfair game.
They're schemers. Schemers trying to control their little worlds.
Rich get richer, that's the law of the land.
It's just money.
Blasphemy! This is madness!
I drink your milkshake!
Hey everybody, welcome back to Milkshakes, Markets, Madness. My name is John Katsumita. I'm joined here with Brent Johnson. This is a show about financial markets, hence the markets piece. The milkshake name is part of the dollar milkshake theory, which is something Brent came up to describe the financial system and how it currently operates. And the madness piece, well, Brent, let's not waste any time because we were just talking about, to be honest with everybody, how maddening this market is. And I want everyone to be honest with themselves because no one has it right yet. We are so violently sideways that I think we're all getting ready to pull our hair out because there's no real direction or trend.
Yeah, you know, I just sent out a tweet a little bit ago and we've referenced this on the show and I've referenced it in different interviews and, you know, just on Twitter and stuff. But, you know, this whole notion of violently sideways. So we just finished April, had a nice rally into the last couple days of April. And so I just pulled up kind of a long-term chart and realized we're at the exact same place we were 1 year ago. And then I zoomed out a little bit more and we are exactly where we were a year before that. And we're not that far away from where we were a year before that, except for the year before that was, you know, if you kind of smoothed it out for COVID, it wasn't even that different. I mean, it was different, but not quite as different. And so we've gone a long time without that much change. And when I say violent sideways, we went down a lot, we went up a lot, we went down a lot, we went up about, but we're basically in the same place. If you're just a buy and hold investor, you're base and you didn't do anything other than potentially some fees that you paid and dividends you received, you're basically in the same place you were 2 years ago, despite all of the narratives, either to the upside or to the downside. And, you know, I don't get frustrated very often. I like to think that kind of one of my skill sets is to kind of not get too emotional about anything and just kind of stay the course. But even I'm getting frustrated because, you know, I'm trying to figure out what happens next. I don't know what happens next. And I've kind of got this dual mandate where I manage overall portfolios. And we have a bunch of long assets that we've owned for literally years. You know, the clients own real estate. We own the same stocks. We've got some short-term fixed income and T-bills and gold. And our overall portfolio hasn't changed that much. And the reason we own those is because despite all the negative things that could happen in the world, asset prices tend to rise, right? I mean, you just zoom out and look at it, asset prices tend to rise. And when they don't rise, governments and monetary authorities typically come in and rig the system in order to make them rise again, right? But there are also time periods, at least very short time periods, where really dramatic drawdowns happen. And I think we're at this point in history where we could experience a very dramatic drawdown. So as a result, in addition to the long assets and the separately managed accounts, you know, you and I have talked about it, we run this tail risk fund. And the tail risk fund is only supposed to pay off if we get a crisis and some kind of spiking volatility. Well, you can imagine how that fund has done because volatility closed below 16 today. It's the lowest level in a couple years. 16 is historically pretty low. You know, and you would think with all the, John, you and I could talk for another hour and we could not name all the potential risks out there. There's tons of them. But despite that, you know, we've got this Goldilocks scenario in the market, risk assets are rallying, VIX is below 16. And so the tail risk fund is struggling. You get into a situation where some clients think, well, we don't need the tail risk fund because that's a drag on the portfolio. Well, the problem is if you don't have the insurance on the portfolio, then you have to manage the rest of the portfolio a little differently. So it's kind of this interesting thing because I'm always trying to fight my bias. I think people that have listened to me and have followed our show, They know that when it comes to the market, I'm a little bit skeptical, a little bit pessimistic about it. But I always fight that. And I'm always trying to figure out where I can be wrong. And that's quite honestly why we've remained long all of these assets. And it's why we've done okay over the last couple of years, because we have remained long despite our predilection to the downside. And when I look at this chart and when I look at where the markets are and when everybody, literally everybody tells me we're guaranteed to have a recession in the second half of the year, I don't know. You know, won't surprise me. Maybe this chart breaks out to the upside. Maybe we get some kind of a Goldilocks scenario into the second half of the year. Now, does that mean I'm going to go out and change my portfolio? Probably not. All it means is that I'm always trying to fight my bias and I'm trying to figure out where I could be wrong. And, you know, there's a lot of people who've been calling for a recession since 2008. they've been on the sidelines since the global financial crisis. And, you know, here we are 15 years later and, you know, maybe they'll be right, but so far they haven't been.
Oh, and they're going to feel like heroes when they finally get it right, despite the massive amount of wealth growth that they've missed. You know, this morning there was a really nice sunrise. I'm a big sunset sunrise person. Currently, I'm on the East Coast, so it's our east facing coast. So it's sunrises this time of where, you know, my travels take me. What was really interesting about this morning is there was a massive rainbow. Now, you typically don't get rainbows in the morning because there's not enough sunlight coming up to make that whole spectrum work. But the thing that's interesting about rainbows, whether it's sunset or sunrise, is that all your attention is on the sun for obvious reasons. The sunrise and sunset's a beautiful moment, but the rainbow happens behind you. Because the sunlight is being sent into, well, you're going to need some kind of rain, but typically some sort of weather system is kind of flowing in behind you while you still have enough exposure for the sun to shoot that light backwards. So I bring up that little description because, number one, it's ironic this morning we would have, if I didn't turn around and look, I would have missed this insane double rainbow. And I think it fits kind of what we're talking about here, because you can get so focused on the risks that are really, really legitimate concerns. And for someone like you who's got to structure a portfolio around that, that's not an easy task. But sometimes because we're playing defense so much, we don't actually turn around and notice, you know, this beautiful economy that could very well right now even be flourishing. So it is part of, like you said, fighting those bias, but sometimes it's not even about fighting the bias. It's just maybe turning around and looking at things slightly differently.
Yeah, I think it's so easy to kind of get caught in your own head, right? And the thing is when you really study the markets right now, like I said, there are so many things that could go wrong. I mean, again, I can list 20 things that could cause the market to fall 5 or 10%. And yet none of them might matter, and one small little anecdote for the other way may send it, you know, 10% higher. And that's the thing, you just don't know. And so this is for anybody who came here looking for clarity and certainty, this is not the place to find it. We don't talk about certainty. And you know, I will say that I think I have fairly good clarity. I'm not confused by anything, but I just don't have conviction on anything right now, because I just think we're in this really weird place. Now, I know there's people out there are saying, oh, you are crazy. We are so headed for a recession. And here's the thing, I tend to agree with you. But I'm not certain about it. And, you know, the markets, for everybody who is certain that we are going into a recession and a huge drawdown, it's been a frustrating year.
Well, I think a lot of what you're talking about when you're giving these perspectives and you're sharing your thoughts are sometimes about markets that are a little distant for people. The equity market, how many people are actually trading those markets? You know, maybe they're invested in some kind of ETF or whatever they're doing for their retirement plan. I think it's, for most people, it's kind of they leave it and don't touch it, which probably is a good thing. Once you start getting into volatility, it's more of a conversation piece probably for most people. I mean, how many people are actually trading volatility and structuring a portfolio around that? But on the point you were making, one of the things I think people can grasp is exactly what you just described is happening in the housing market. There is endless amounts of data that I think are really, really valid in terms of why we should be concerned. The price to income ratio and just the median income and the median home prices, and just looking at the chart and seeing what it, you know, the parabolic rise that we had, and now interest rates are higher, but home prices have remained resilient in the face of all those things. In February, home prices actually ticked up. And I think it's going to be one of those, which you don't necessarily have in the equity markets per se, but it feels like at least in housing, it's going to be one of those regional things. You know, parts of California could get crushed, but not maybe all of California. You might have a big exodus from certain states, but then maybe places like Florida do very, very well. And then you're looking at aggregate data and it says the market is flat, you know, so real estate's kind of going through a violently sideways. But then people get all worked up like, oh, there's just vacancies everywhere in my neighborhood. And it's like, well, maybe in a neighborhood of 150 people, is it even relevant? So I think there's, you know, to help give people some context, like, same thing that's driving you nuts in the housing market. Do I buy now? Do I wait? Everyone's looking for that certainty. And anyone who's selling you that certainty is actually selling you something else.
Yeah, you know, I totally agree with you on this. And, you know, again, I think for anybody who has a strong conviction, if they haven't already done it, I think a great task to do is to argue the other side. And in fact, I'm going to George Gammon's conference in a couple of weeks in Orlando. I'm really looking forward to it. And I was talking to him the other day, and he asked me what my presentation was going to be. And I said, I didn't know. I got to figure it out. But I think what I'm going to do is I think, no guarantees, but I think I'm going to argue the opposite of all my ideas. And I think I'm going to show people these are I'm going to come out there and I'm going to say, I'm bullish equities. I'm bearish the dollar. I think, you know, just make up, but show them how to argue the other side, because I think it's a very, not only is it a very useful, because you will not only make if you're right, your understanding of the other side will make your argument even stronger. But if you're wrong, it might actually open your ideas or open your mind to how you could potentially get it wrong and then protect against that. So I'm kind of looking forward to doing that. I haven't decided exactly how I'm going to do it yet, but that's what I'm thinking about. So, but yeah, it's a time period, and like an example, like think about what we have coming up over the next 6 weeks or 7 weeks. We have two Fed meetings. We've got inflation data for May and June. We have the potential debt ceiling showdown, right? And think about what's going on with all of this. So inflation, the year-over-year inflation numbers are probably going to start falling, right? Because it was probably last May, June, and July where they were really peaking, and we were having the really high single-digit year-over-year inflations. Well, now we're comping against last year's numbers. So we are probably going to see those inflation numbers coming down. And think about this for a second. Let's say 2 years ago, if we would have said we're going to have 4.5% inflation, people would have said, holy cow, that's a lot of inflation. But now Fed funds are going to be at 5% or 5.5%. So we could get into June and have positive real rates, right? Okay, so what do positive real rates mean? Well, positive real rate, that's not typically an indicator of an imminent recession. Things are pretty good. If your rates are higher than your inflation, that's not a horrible thing. It's not necessarily bullish, but it's not a horrible thing. Higher real rates should attract capital from around the world into your now higher rates. I think if that were to happen, we would be the only major economy with positive real rates. Okay, so now if we have positive real rates, that should be positive for the dollar. The dollar's, you know, come down a lot over the last 6 months. But now if you have the highest real rates, you would think that would attract capital flows, potentially push the dollar higher. But at the same time, we're going to be bumping up against the debt ceiling and the debt ceiling showdown, in which the government can't even pay their bills. So if you're going to default, or even if it's, first of all, the debt ceiling will absolutely be raised. Anybody who's thinking about this, there's no debate. The debt ceiling will be raised. The question is, when does it get raised and what's the political drama that leads up to it, right? Both sides want to spend money. They need to raise the debt ceiling in order to do that. So, but it's possible. Maybe they will do like a 1 or 2 day default. Now, that would be stupid. It would be horrible, but it would be over relatively quickly. Everybody who owns a treasury bill is still going to get their interest. But having that quote unquote technical default for a couple days or a week, that would be really bad for the U.S. So that way you would think that would be bad for markets and bad for the dollar, right? But that counteracts with what the other thing I was just saying. So you've got all of these different things that are happening, and this is all going to happen in the next, you know, 6 to 8 weeks. So I think May and June are going to be fascinating, for lack of a better word.
So you brought up real rates, and you also mentioned that you're potentially going to flip your presentation against yourself, so to speak, at this conference with George Gammon. So in line of both of those things, one of the things I hear all the time, and it makes sense to me, you know, you kind of made a point there that, hey, real rates are not necessarily a bad thing. We should want interest rates to outpace inflation. And one would argue that would continue to add to inflation because now people are getting a yield and can feel confident about going out and either making business decisions or reinvesting. But I hear it over and over because of the size of debt to GDP in a lot of the developed economies like the US and Japan, that these economies cannot function or stomach real rates. Do you have any thoughts on that, just maybe as a potential preparation for this presentation?
Yeah. Well, as a general rule, an economy cannot handle rates that are too high, right? And if you keep raising rates forever and ever and ever, eventually you will hit a point where the interest can't be paid and you will have a credit contraction. So I do agree that these higher interest rates are going to cause a problem. I think part of the reason they haven't caused a problem yet, and I think we've touched on this before, is that, you know, these rate hikes really only started 13 months ago. And most of the rate hikes that we've experienced, we haven't even hit the 12-month mark yet. But we're going to start hitting those over the next 2 or 3 months. We're going to start hitting the meat of all those interest rate hikes. And while interest rate hikes, just the federal funds rate being raised, it does have an impact on the economy immediately. The full effect really doesn't hit again until 12 to 18 months later, because a lot of times stuff gets refinanced, right? When people borrow money, there's typically some kind of a maturity, whether it's 2 years or 3 years or 5 years or 10 years or 30. But the point is a lot of corporate loans, a lot of commercial real estate, a lot of debt-based financing out there, you know, kind of happens in the 3 to 7 year range, right? Or the 3 to 5 year range. And so if you think about what happened in 2019 and 2020 with COVID, and then everybody started refinancing. So that was 2 or 3 years ago now, right? So now we're going to start hitting where all of these, not all of them, but we're going to, because it's been 2 or 3, 4 years now, we're going to start hitting these periods where people are going to start refinancing their loans or their leases or whatever it is. And they're going to be doing it at rates that are 3 or 4 times as high as they were, or maybe I'm being dramatic, 2 times as high as they were, you know, a couple of years ago. And then when they do that, their monthly payments go up tremendously, right? Or maybe they even have to put down more capital or whatever it is. And so that's when you really start to see the interest rates hit. Now, I'm kind of the opinion that the Fed isn't going to raise a lot more. I think that they're going to raise at least one more time, maybe two more times, and then they're just going to pause and they're going to wait for something to break. And I think they want something to break. Again, the whole point of raising rates is to slow the economy. I think they would love to get a soft landing, but I think Powell himself would admit that a soft landing is pretty unlikely. In fact, he's basically said, without quite saying it, he's basically said a soft landing is unlikely. And we're probably going to have to experience some pain in order to get the inflationary pressures down. And people are going to have to lose their jobs. And while that pain is going to be unfortunate, it's better than the pain caused by prolonged inflation. So I don't think that Powell is going to, just as soon as we see one little downtick in economic expansion, I don't think he's going to immediately pivot. Now, if we get some kind of a crisis and a complete lack of liquidity, then yeah, I mean, that's his job. That he'll definitely step in. So I think what could happen is, I think it's possible that we could just grind sideways for 6 months, or, you know, continue this violently sideways where we go up a little bit, down a little bit. And I think that could cause market participants as much pain as anything. Because what do? You hedge the downside or do you buy the breakout? Do you hedge the sound? You end up getting cut to ribbons trying to trade it back and forth. And I don't want this to happen because it would drive me crazy as too, but I'm kind of coming around to the idea that we could just grind sideways for another 6 to 12 months.
Yeah, and why only 6 to 12 months? I mean, are we at an early stage of turning Japanese? I don't think we are because of how aggressive the Fed has been able to be on rate hikes and so far have not broken anything. And when you're talking real rates, I mean, that's not something Japan has had for how many decades. But what has, you know, let's describe any, you know, their equity market any different than the conversation we're having right now? It's just been decades of sideways and nothing. Now, I feel like we have slightly more free, if you will, capital markets. There's not that heavy-handed type of intervention. But, you know, even as we're having this conversation, 6 to 12 months, I think, is like, sure, I could see why that would be a base case. But are we actually talking about, you know, violently sideways for 36 months? I mean, like, for people in the markets, it would drive you nuts. But for the average person, they just get on with their life. And this becomes, you know, kind of becomes the new reality. And, you know, talking earlier about, you know, well, you just said, how would you, you know, do you hedge the downside or, you know, try to catch the rip? But earlier in the conversation, you had talked about, you know, the cost of hedging, but at the same time, the importance of it. I think it's a great way to pivot into something that we're seeing and has been going on for a little bit in terms of the banking crises. And now we have First Republic Bank. They've been in the headlines the whole time. You know, it just gets worse and worse, and it seems like they're on their last breath every single time. And, you know, to anybody who's has insurance and is thinking about taking it off and perhaps, you know, some of the conversations you're having with your clients, one of the things that caught Silver Bank, and it's actually a big part of First Republic's problems, is they got rid of the interest rate hedges.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, and so that's a perfect example of as rates rise, or at least they stay high, it will eventually find its way and show up into the economy, right? Now, the reason it started to finally show up wasn't because of necessarily the interest rate hikes. The interest rate hikes caused the securities that the bank, the First Republic, Silicon Valley, these other banks own, to drop in value, at least if they were marked to market. But these banks don't have to mark them to market, and they can either hedge them, or if they don't hedge them, they can pledge them as long-term securities, and then they account for them differently. They don't have to show the market-based price. So that isn't even what caused the interest rate hikes is not what caused the problem. What caused the problem is that the banks, who have not paid depositors anything for their savings for years, didn't also raise rates and pay their depositors as rates started to rise. And so depositors started to look elsewhere. Why would you put your money in a bank that pays you 2% or 1.5% or 2.25%, whatever it is, when you can go into a government-backed money market fund or T-bill and get 4.5%? It makes no sense to leave. You're taking all the risk of a bank when you could be fully backed by the government. And so as those deposits have left the banks and the banks had to free up cash to let those deposits go, then they had to start selling those securities at a loss, right? And so this kind of comes back to your real estate question a little bit. You know, so far we haven't seen a whole lot of problem in the real estate market, and perhaps we won't see a whole lot of problems in the real estate market. But if and when people have to start selling for whatever reason and have to actually start marking the prices to market because they're now selling at a lower price, that would be interesting. Maybe we will see a dislocation in the real estate market. But if we just grind sideways and no forced selling happens again, a lot of times problems happen when you are a forced seller, right? And this is why I always say in your portfolio, either have insurance or have some cash, have something so that you don't become a forced seller. Because if you are a forced seller, not only are you having to sell something that you don't want to sell, but you are stressed out. And if you are stressed out, you are not going to be thinking clearly. And so even if you have cash in your portfolio, and you think it's a drag because we have high inflation, that drag in your portfolio might actually end up saving your bacon someday because it'll allow you to make a more well thought out, rational decision rather than a stressed out decision.
So the hedges can be expensive. They can, in the short term, cause some frustration, but in aggregate, it's important to have, and it shouldn't completely offset the other aspects of how a portfolio is performing. But again, violently sideways, we conviction's important, but certainty is something to stay away from. We don't really know how this is going to play out. I mean, it from forward guidance and everything else that we're seeing, the Fed has at least another hike. And I think every month we're going to say, well, I could see them doing another 0.25%. And this kind of goes back to the trend of things where the dollar at the end of last year was causing a lot of pain, mainly because of these rate hikes. That has kind of seemed to settled in, and now you're starting to see the dollar weaker for all kinds of narratives. But one of them got me thinking, because we've talked about, in reference to the dollar milkshake theory, that what actually breaks the financial system, in your view, is when the dollar gets so incredibly strong that everything starts to turn into chaos everywhere else. There's capital flight, etc. So lately we've had this, and because of that, as you've pointed out, the weaker dollar keeps the music going. You know, the game goes on. So what kind of got me thinking, because lately we've had this whole, you know, hype around the BRICS and the BRICS coming up with their own reserve currency, and it's going to replace the dollar. I kind of had my scratch in my head the other day. I'm like, I wonder, because we also talk about a lot how everything is coordinated. And yes, there's some tension. This doesn't necessarily mean that everyone likes each other, but, you know, these people that are in positions of power and wealth aren't going to necessarily get, you know, their socks in a bunch and torch the quality of life that they have just because they don't like, you know, the dollar as a reserve currency or the US dollar policy. So anyways, the point is, what it got me thinking about was, I wonder if there's a coordinated conversation to push this narrative of, hey, we're going to do this with China, we're going to come up with this BRICS thing to take a lot of the air out of that US dollar balloon.
I think that's absolutely the case. And I'll give you a little insight here. And while I'm not going to drop any names, I was in DC last October. And if you remember, the dollar peaked at the end of September, had a little bit of dip in early October, and then it went back, almost retested the top at the very first week of November, and then it sold off very hard. So in that period where the dollar was kind of at its peak, I was in Washington, D.C., and I was talking with the, let's just say, policymaker types who are in a position to know. And there is no question that policymakers in Washington, D.C. were getting calls from all over the world, from both friend and foe, that what the hell are you doing? You have to take your foot off the gas with this dollar. You are absolutely killing us, right? And just remember, at the end of September, the Bank of Japan... So first of all, China had been easing their monetary policy to deal with their real estate market and to kind of keep their growth going. And then at the end of September, the Bank of Japan, the Bank of England, and the ECB all in some form or another had to intervene in their markets. I mean, so we were on the verge of a crisis. And this is the crisis. It was the exact crisis that I have long expected. And I expected the central banks to come out and try to squash it. And they did. And they were successful, right? And this is typically, this is typically what happens. Like, again, the reason I'm not all in on a crisis is because monetary authorities and governments are extremely good at kicking the can down the road. So I don't have all of my money in cash or in some kind of a tail risk that I think the whole world's going to blow up and I have all my bet on that. They're actually very good at kicking the can down the road, and they will be, I think they will tend to be more successful in that more often than not. The problem is the one or two times when they are not successful, you get either like a 2020 COVID type event, or you get a 2008 global financial crisis type event. And I think we're at a point in history where it's unwise not to be prepared for that, right? But when I was in DC and I was talking to these people, it became very clear that they were not just worried about what would happen to the other countries, but they're worried about the blowback against America, right? Again, you can only push people so far before they react. And this is the other thing. People think that I don't understand that the US just can't tell people to do what to do and they'll automatically do it. I get it. There will absolutely be pushback. But the US is still the biggest boy on the block, right? And they can push people around and they can tell people what to do. That doesn't mean that everybody will always do it, but they have many, many levers they can pull to influence global events. But at the same time, even though they want to be on top, and even though they want to put pressure on different groups at different times in order to get them to go along with their policies, they don't want the whole world to burn, right? They don't want the whole system to come down. So when it, you know, they can exert pressure and they can push, but they don't want to break the system, right? And so the point is that I think there was coordination, but there wasn't a coordination to weaken the dollar. And so what I mean by that is there was no arm twisting to say, hey, we have to devalue the dollar. Will you please help us? Everybody wanted the dollar to weaken. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, there's no conspiracy to weaken the dollar. Everybody was, please weaken the dollar. And the other thing was, is they didn't have to come to some super accord where all these different countries had to work together to weaken the dollar. All they had to do was stop hiking interest rates at the same pace that they already had. Again, this is not a big conspiracy theory here. The pullback in the dollar over the last 6 months, to me, is easily explainable by rate hike expectations. So that's the part of the dollar coming down. But the other part of it is what you're talking about. This is when the other countries kind of coordinate to come out with this message, right? This unified message of de-dollarization. And to me, there's no question that's been coordinated in some fashion or not. I don't know if you've ever seen those things on these mashups of the news where news stations all over the country, they'll show them and they're saying the exact same words. And it's in 20 different things, and they're literally saying the exact same words. So there's obviously coordination. And I think there is a lot of that going on here with the BRICS and the de-dollarization effort. And I think there is some of that. And I think that's part of the reason why the dollar's pulled back so much. But along those same lines, it's one thing to talk the talk. It's another to actually do it. And so what I have found amazing is the willingness of people to hear the headline or read the headline and just accept it as fact. And I'll give you a good example. Just this in the last week, I don't remember exactly, I think it was earlier this week or late last week, a headline came out that now Argentina was only going to trade with China in yuan. They were going to pay for Chinese yuan or Chinese imports in yuan, and they were no longer going to pay them in dollars. Well, there's a reason for this. It's because they don't have any more dollars. You can't pay somebody in dollars if you don't have any dollars. And China still wants to get paid in some form. They don't want to get nothing. They don't want to be defaulted on. So China will loan money to Argentina in yuan. Argentina will take those yuan, give it back to China, and then China will send them the goods. So again, is it de-dollarization? Yes, in a sense, but not in the way that I think many people, you know, read the headline. And, you know, if you actually look into the article, I actually brought it up here. If you look into the article and actually read what is said, along kind of at the bottom, it says, this agreement will allow Argentina to work on the possibility of advancing the rate of imports. So think about that. To work on, which means it's not done yet. They're going to have to work on it. The possibility, which isn't a, you know, again, this could potentially happen. It's not happening. So they're going to work on the possibility of advancing. All of these things are in the future as potential outcomes. But the headline is it's here today. And We've talked about this before. And my whole thing with the whole dollar milkshake theory and pounding the table on the dollar is not because I want everybody to go all in on the dollar. I just told you earlier, my portfolio is very little in the dollar. I'm in a bunch of assets. But what the whole point of the theory is to convince you not to go all in against it. And so when I see all of these headlines and I hear all this rhetoric and this, to your point, this constant coordinated boom, 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 the whole spidey sense goes up. Hopefully, you know, through these conversations, the people listening, their spidey sense starts to go up too. And when you read a unified message like this that comes at you from all different angles, you got to ask yourself, why are you hearing it and why are you hearing it now? Right? And I think that's a big part of this right now. So don't, whenever you see something like this, dig. Don't accept it as pure fact. Don't just accept the headline. Dig in there, do your own homework. And listen, at the end of the day, come to your own conclusion. If you do the research and you still come to the conclusion that de-dollarization is happening, I'm totally fine with that. But when I ask somebody what they're basing their decision on and they say a headline, then I know they haven't done their work.
Yeah, and of all places, today I retweeted some snippets from an article that Bloomberg put out, and I feel like Bloomberg is turning more and more sensational, just like the rest of them, that this article, in my opinion, and kind of the way it was framed, was way more bullish the U.S. economy and the dollar. It was talking about how there's this massive capital flight out of Latin America. And again, where do you think that money's going? And one of the places they highlighted in this article was Miami. So it's not like they're bringing the Argentinian peso and buying an apartment or buying groceries in Miami with anything but the dollar. So it's and that's an important thing too, not to go down dollar milkshake rabbit hole, but this isn't, you know, someone fleeing with their last $5. The wealthy are exiting these places. And that's very, very frightening for these economies, because that's really, especially in Latin America, you have a couple, you know, a lot of these countries are a handful of uber wealthy. And if that capital starts to flee the country, things can get really bad and continue to just stay bad for a long time. And Argentina's kind of been that running joke for a long time. All they ever do is default. So, you know, potentially to take us out here, you know, wrapping up what we've talked about, the violently sideways thing was something, you know, you were really highlighting in the equity markets, the S&P. You've kind of seen this go on now the last 2 years, but maybe the message here for everybody is, you know, be aware of how violently sideways everything can go. Real estate could be violently sideways, equity markets, violently sideways, bond markets, central bank policy, you know, reserve currency rhetoric. So, you know, careful you're not, this could be very much could be a 10 round fight. So don't get yourself all gassed up in the first two rounds and get shaky legs and not be able to stick around for when, you know, you really need to land that sucker punch.
It's a good way to say it. Stay around till you get the opportunity for the sucker punch. I like that. Yeah,
Maybe we'll call it a sucker punch, a knockout punch. We don't want to be sucker punching.
Listen, if you're patient, you know, somebody's going to give you an opportunity for a sucker punch. You just got to be patient. I'm stealing that, John. That's a good one.
Okay. You could put that in your presentation. All right, Brent, look, man, it's always a fun chat. I think our followers are going to enjoy this. And if you're new to the show, please subscribe and follow. You can find us on YouTube at Milkshakes Pod. It's the same handle we use on Twitter at Milkshakes Pod. Brent is very active on social media, if you didn't already know that, at Santiago AU Fund. You can find me at John Kutzmita, and we hope to find you anywhere on the internet. And hopefully you are thriving and doing well and finding a way to survive in the violently sideways world. Brent, thanks so much.